Construction Superintendent Charles Vitchers and crane operator Bobby Gray were both on their own construction sites the morning of September 11, 2001. But within hours of the attack, they were at ground zero, using their construction expertise to make the site safer for rescue workers, help search for remains, and clear out rubble. Their experiences at the site are recounted in a book, 9 Months at Ground Zero, the story of a brotherhood of workers who took on a job like no other. It's based on their interviews with writer Glenn Stout. Terry Gross spoke with Vitchers and Gray about their work at the site.
Would you describe what the pile looked like in the beginning when you first started to participate in the deconstruction?
I think it's so important to describe the response. It was it made you feel so good to see. It just was like this American response, like, you know, you sucker punch us, you know, you knocked the wind out of us, but, you know, we're getting right back up again. And that's the feeling I kind of got from it. I had heard estimates of up to like 5,000 people on that pile. And it was every denomination, every gender, every religious, any person that was around there that thought they could help came down. Now, with that said, as good as that made you feel, you had to realize that 100 yards away there was a 40-story building in flames and 5,000 people right next to it on a bucket brigade. And that's how chaotic it was. So in one sense, it made you feel really good to see the response. But you also knew that this was just so incredibly dangerous that at any given point we could start adding casualties instead of recoveries.
Would you describe some of the precautions you had to take when you were actually working on the pile?
Yeah. The biggest problem down there was the heat and the smoke and the dust. You didn't know where you could go until you moved so far into the pile that the heat got so intense that you'd be standing on a beam and realize that the smell you're smelling is your boots are burning. The bottom of the rubber on your boots is starting to melt. It was September. We all had long jeans on. We were kind of dressed well. I was wearing a flannel shirt, and you'd feel your neck getting hot just from walking by some of this steel. And then you started to look and realize that these pieces of steel that some of the guys were trying to pull out with some of the equipment were cherry red hot. It was like a poker in a fireplace. That's one way I explained it. Cherry red pieces of steel that when you put them on a dunnage, which is wood on the back of some of these trucks, the dunnage would catch on fire. So you'd pull sticks out, you'd have to put them down and hose them down for 3 or 4 hours before you could actually move them.
You know, just you describe in the book that even walking on the pile, it was like walking on a suspension bridge. With each step, you could feel some
Absolutely.
Kind of sway or give. Were you worried that there'd be a collapse of part of the pile and somebody would fall in and get seriously injured or killed?
Absolutely. When we first went in to approach the slurry wall and get onto the pile itself within the slurry wall, the slurry wall was about 70 feet deep, which is six levels of basement were there, and the debris was collapsed in it. And it was like pickup sticks. Try walking on pickup sticks of steel with 200,000 to 300,000-pound machines. Something moves, you're gone. And when you walked out there with the machinery working in proximity, it would always shake. We got infrared aerial shots from the Army Corps of Engineers. They showed us where the heat below was. It would be 2,400 degrees. The steel we knew was still burning hot and possibly melting. The steel was being stressed, so you never knew what the conditions were going to be 5 hours later. It could be totally safe, and then all of a sudden the heat would stress and stuff would start moving around. So we took 60, 70-ton pieces of steel that we took from the perimeter and basically made like a bridge on top of the debris to get the machinery out. This way, if there was a collapse down there, at least the machine wasn't going to fall into a hole. It would drop, but it wasn't going to fall into a void and just disappear on us. And that was common sense things were done down there because you couldn't engineer this job, and there was no blueprint to work from.
Bobby Gray, you were overseeing some of the machinery that was being used. Give us a sense of what was being used and for what purposes.
Being a crane operator myself, my initial thought was that I needed to get some very heavy capacity mobile hydraulic cranes, and which are these huge cranes that come in on rubber tires, and they set up fairly quickly, and they have great lifting capacities. But then, never having been on a demolition job before, I was introduced to this machine called a grappler, which is essentially typically like a backhoe that you would see on an excavation site where a bucket scoops in back towards the machine. But instead of a bucket, they put an articulating tine on it. So you have three tines on the top and two on the bottom, and they can come down and clasp, sort of like closing your fist on a pile of sand. And I saw the operators starting to use this machine, this grappler, and was amazed. And within a week or two, realized that the cranes, because we couldn't breach the slurry wall with the cranes, that these grapplers were able to, with their track machine, so they were able to track up onto debris piles and were getting into places where a crane could never get. And I soon realized that this was going to be the machine of choice. This was the way we were going to disassemble this mess.
They could get where cranes couldn't because they were smaller and lighter?
They are typically smaller, although there are some very big ones, but their ability to displace their weight evenly because they're a track machine, they have steel cats, and they're much more agile as far as when they're traveling on the cats, they can get and climb, whereas a crane, because it usually has a large boom on it, can't sort of go side to side. It gets very unstable, where these grapplers can actually climb and walk and backtrack and just much more efficient up on the debris pile.
Forgive my lack of knowledge of this, but what are cats?
Cats are the steel pads, if you will, instead of having rubber tires. You know, on an army tank, you see the treads that
yeah.
propel the tank.
Yeah.
Almost identical, except they're usually a little bit bigger and heavier on the grappler.
Okay. So was the grappler operated in a certain way to preserve remains or so that you could look for remains?
Absolutely. They initiated a process called a daisy chain, and you would go in and grab a small amount of material in the tines, and you would shake it out, and the fire department had spotters. So what would happen is you would take some of this material out from the pile, and you would spread it out in front of the spotters, which were mostly FDNY, and they would search through it by hand and rakes.
Were there a lot of remains that were found on your watch and Charlie Vitcher's on your watch?
Yes, there. It's not comfortable too much speaking about the remains, but to answer your question, it was a 24/7 recovery operation. There was always recoveries going on every day. I only remember one period of time where we went maybe a week or 2 weeks and really didn't get any recoveries. And then all of a sudden you'd hit a mass of, you know, 70 people. It was incredible. We discussed it. That opened up every conversation in the meeting to keep people in tune with what we were doing down there. And you have to realize that to describe the site, I would describe it as emotional all the way through. People were just emotionally attached to finding their brothers, their sisters. We had fathers and mothers. We had brothers looking for their brothers, looking for their fathers, and so on. So it was a very emotional sight. And when you use machinery, the machinery was very delicate to pick apart the steel after the iron workers would burn a section that was manageable. Then the grapplers would come in and lift that section of steel, move it out of the way, get the rescue workers in there to see if there were any recoveries, and we basically took the site down that way. Nothing got moved once or twice or three times without getting looked at each time before it finally found its way to the barge, which then took it to Staten Island, where it was again looked at. So it was very intense and foremost on everybody's mind that we weren't there to just dismantle this job and get the steel off and start to rebuild the site. We could have done that in a month and a half. We were there to do the right thing and make the recoveries the right way, and that's how everybody proceeded on the job.
Were the remains that you saw on your watch whole bodies or limbs or just like things even smaller, you know, than limbs that you knew were human remains?
Most of the remains that were found by the rescue recovery workers. You had volunteers from every nation in the world there. Cadaver dogs were finding stuff. And we didn't really get involved with it as construction workers. We just supplied the machinery and the manpower and the iron workers and the burners to take the site apart so that the recovery workers could go in there and recover any remains they found. As far as visceral descriptions, I can't go there, Terry, because it's just too wide of a range, and it hurts too much when you bring it back up and people, especially family members, have to relive it.
And Bobby Gray, do you share that discomfort in talking about the remains? The impression I get from the book is that it almost feels like disrespectful to you to discuss it.
It's it took a toll on all of us. I kind of would agree with Charlie. It's something we tried to steer away from in the book, any kind of real description, only because it's so difficult for the families first and foremost, but also for the people that were there and had to experience it. Someone once said that you're seeing things that God never intended you to see, and to me that kind of just says it all.
Bobby Gray and Charles Vitcher speaking with Terry Gross. More with them after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Bobby Gray and Charles Vitcher. They have a new book about their time spent cleaning up Ground Zero. When we left off, they were talking about finding remains among the rubble.
I was surprised to read about what you didn't find, which was virtually anything else. What didn't you find that you expected to find?
Well, I figured working in the pile and having previously worked in the Trade Center as a carpenter and then as a foreman for years, I fit out many floors in both of those towers through the years. And like a refrigerator or water bottles or couches or furniture, desks, you would think you'd find something like that. Everything was pulverized, and what was amazing is that we did find remains. I don't know how that happened, but the only thing that was in that pile was concrete, steel, and whatever remains we could find, and anything else that was in the contents of those both buildings, probably because of the friction of the collapse of the building, was totally just pulverized. So that was kind of strange walking through it. And then you'd turn around and you'd find a cell phone or you'd find an ID tag or you'd find a photo album that might have been sitting on somebody's desk. And the only way to understand how that got down into the pile without getting crushed or burnt was that it floated down. Certain paper flew across to Brooklyn for days. After the collapse of the building, they were finding notes from people's desks in the Trade Center in Red Hook, Brooklyn, downtown Brooklyn. The wind just carried this stuff around. So that was strange.
Bobby Gray, anything that surprised you about what you did or didn't find?
It surprised me that some of the glass survived. And you could tell some of the higher floors because the glass was half as thick as the glass on the lower floors. Typically, everything in the Trade Center, as it got higher, the materials got lighter so that the building could withstand the extra weight. And we did find some of the exterior glass, and you could pick it up and hold it in your hand. You would know it was from a higher floor up top or close to the top. And you'd also find pieces of glass from the lower floors, you know, that was much thicker. And you just wonder, why, how did that get through that tremendous energy of floor impacting floor after floor and the grinding and the pulverizing that went on.
Have either of you been having any kind of health-related problems that you connect to the 9 months that you spent working at Ground Zero?
Well, I still have I still have a cough. It's been diagnosed as a non-productive cough. I guess it's AKA the World Trade Center cough. And every once in a while, that seems to flare up. And the only reason why I go to a doctor is when it starts to interrupt my sleep. So I've gone twice. I've gone to Mount Sinai, has a program for recovery workers. I've been up to that. What is difficult is wondering every time you get the onset of a cold or something, you know, is this the time bomb ticking? Or is, you know, is the fuse lit? Is this cough that I have a cold, or is this going to manifest into something worse? And that, you try and compartmentalize that and put it someplace in the back of your mind. But every once in a while, you know, as a few months ago, I started to get a cold, and I'm sitting here wondering, I said, oh my God, is this the big one? So you have to deal with that on a daily basis.
So what are you each doing now?
Well, right now I'm assigned to a new building coming out of the ground at the 15 William Street, downtown Manhattan. It's going to be a 39-story building, and we're just blasting concrete right now with getting the foundation ready to start.
And I'm still bouncing around Manhattan trying to help build skyscrapers, whether it be on a crane or as a master mechanic or whatever it is I can do to help.
So it sounds like you're definitely not phobic about skyscrapers after having seen the World Trade Center collapse.
Absolutely not.
No, not at all. Not at all. One of the perks of my job is I always get the office with the best view.
Well, thank you very much, both of you. Thank you.
Terry, thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Thank you very much. Yep.
Construction Superintendent Charles Vitchers and crane operator Bobby Gray. Their experiences at the World Trade Center site are recounted in the book 9 Months at Ground Zero.